danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 280 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from Baltimore, Maryland. I'm Andrew Brokus. I'll be joined in just a moment by Nate Mavis in Melrose, Massachusetts, and also by our guest, Tony Newman, who is somewhere in Minnesota. I forgot to get his exact whereabouts. Tony has been a long-time listener to the Thinking Poker Podcast, long-time interactor on Twitter. Got to meet him in Las Vegas over the summer. And you actually, well, if you've been listening to the show, on episode 267, we discussed a strategy hand that Tony submitted. The details aren't terribly important, except that, well, there's two things that are kind of significant. One is that the villain in this hand was Tony's brother, and so Tony gave us the hand actually from the perspective of both players, and we discussed the strategy from the perspective of both Tony and his brother. This is also a hand that began with Tony straddling under the gun, and Nate and I both kind of questioned the wisdom of straddling under the gun. And Tony, I guess, wanted to discuss a few things with us, including to make more of a case for why he thought straddling might be a worthwhile thing to do. He also ended up having an ethics question for us about continuing to invite a player to a home game who seemed like maybe had a problematic relationship with gambling. And we had a pretty interesting conversation about that as well, I would say. Tony contacted me about wanting to discuss these follow-up questions, and specifically kind of proposed in the context of this fundraiser that many of you all know that I've been doing for the Bay Area Urban Debate League. If, you know, if he were to make a sufficiently sized donation to the league, could he maybe come on the show and talk to us? And the one thing I'll say that I also said on Twitter is, you know, this isn't necessarily an open offer. We don't aren't generally in the business of kind of like selling guest spots on the podcast, and mostly our criterion for who's going to make a good guest is who do we think is going to be kind of most entertaining for the audience. And that's not to say that Tony is not an entertaining guest. It's just a more broad policy. I guess I don't want a lot of people coming to me and saying like, hey, if I give you $100, can I be on the podcast? Not often or always something that we're going to do. But as I said, in Tony's case, he's someone that I had met, someone that I know has been a part of the Thinking Poker community for a long time, and someone that I knew had some interesting strategy questions to talk to us about. And I do think that an interesting conversation developed from it. So I hope that you all will enjoy listening to that. Also, I know that this episode is airing on December 31st, so technically the year-end fundraiser is just about over. That said, I had some incentives attached for people who were donating to the Bay Area Urban Debate League as part of this fundraiser. Nate and I have been recording podcasts, in some cases Nate and I, in some cases just me, recording some exclusive podcast episodes where we're answering questions from people who donated. This is how Tony kind of first got in touch with us. So I am going to extend this offer for another week after this episode airs. I'm not going to be recording new podcasts, but you can still, with a donation of $5 or more to the Bay Area Urban Debate League, you can still get all of the podcast that we've recorded. So this is going to be several hours of strategy content that you can get for a donation of as little as $5. There'll be a link in the show notes. If you go to thinkingpoker.net or look on, you know, at Twitter at thinkingpoker, you can find the link to make the donation. I'll get a notification when you do make the donation. Just make sure you put in a viable email so I can send you the links to download the episodes. So all that's available. It will continue to be available through January 7th. So you can still make those donations if you care to. We're going to be talking a lot of strategy with Tony, so let me tell you now that our strategy sponsor is Tournament Poker Edge. If you want to take your tournament game to the next level, check out tournamentpokeredge.com. That's where you'll find instructional videos from myself and many other professional players, many of whom have been guests on this very show. Plenty of others of whom would make good guests on the show, and you may hear in the future. You'll get access to a huge archive of videos, plus several new videos coming out every week for as little as $25 a month. Sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com. So I think Tony and I met in Las Vegas. I don't think, Tony, you've met Nate before, have you?
I have not met Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
I am great. I'm looking forward to this. This is exciting. I can't say I've been with you guys since episode one, but I think I go back to about episode 65 or 70. So,
yeah. Long enough that I cannot remember a time when you were not, in some sense, involved in the community. Thanks.
Yeah, well, and Andrew inspired me that night. I went and I wrote this in my note to you, I think, Andrew, but I did my first 2-5 live game after that at the Rio, did a little warm-up. So that was interesting. I made a little bit. I didn't feel like I made a total fool of myself, so that was good.
Excellent. And let's actually, I've actually already started recording, Tony, if you're comfortable with that. I know I didn't tell you that, but I don't think you said anything too incriminating.
No.
Do you want to back up a little bit and sort of introduce us to Tony the poker player?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I started playing poker before the internet was really a thing. I'm in my mid-40s, and my dad was a big player. So I learned to play for pretzel sticks at the kitchen table when I was about 6 years old. And, you know, grew up, you know, then playing, you know, I actually kind of first learned how to play draw poker and stud and games like Dump on Your Neighbor, where you get one card, and if you think your card is lower than the person's, you pass it to them. But just kind of more of those basic, you know, card building skill foundations of, you know, hey, what cards are good, what cards are bad, learned how to play spades and hearts and those things. And then up through college, played more of the wild card, you know, not a ton of strategy games with my friends. And you know, it was after college when the internet boom hit, and I started to play some on the internet. And now with Black Friday and in a state that doesn't have internet poker, I stick to live games and I've always enjoyed the strategy side. So I read books, go on blogs. I, you know, obviously a big fan of the Thinking Poker podcast, but it feels for me like the last year or two has been a tipping point where I've been consistently winning more money more often. And I think a lot of that's due, you know, to you guys. You've turned me on to both Ed Miller and Tommy Angelo, which have been a huge help. And so, you know, that's where I am now. I'm comfortable playing recreationally. And if I can self-fund my guys' trip to Vegas every 3 years, I consider myself to be doing well.
Yeah, I think self-funding anything, you know, the vast majority of poker players are not making money. So anything that you're funding is a success.
Yes.
If the things that you're funding are your own, then that's a success.
Yeah, I mean, when my wife and I got married, there's an agreement that I have a poker fund, and I haven't had to go into any of quote our money for that. So yeah, I consider that a win.
Nice. Well, congratulations on that. When you say that your dad was a big player, I mean, did you mean he played with his friends, or was he playing like in casinos?
Okay, so well, so both. So to give some perspective, we had a trophy that hung on the wall in our living room for the Larry Newman Invitational Stud Tournament he used to host in our house every year. And it was, he'd usually get 21 guys, and it was 5, 6, or 7 card stud. The dealer got to choose, and I think when the tables were full, you could only play 6 or 5, and then as it weeded down. But he had a tournament where every year the winners were listed, and then the guy, you know, again, this was the 80s, so I remember he'd come downstairs, the living room was filled with smoke and bad beer cans littered all over the place. But, I mean, my dad was a good winning player. He played every month with his friends. He passed away about 20 plus years ago, so I didn't really know him as an adult to get all the details, but I know he had a poker fund. I know he was also a good player amongst his friends. I've, you know, learned from them, you know, some in the time since then. But yeah, he was, you know, he was a winning player as well in recreational games.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So are there any insights that you would point to? I mean, I know you said this has been kind of a breakthrough year for you, and I appreciate you giving us a nod for that. Are there any specific insights that you would point to as kind of like aha moments or things that you think you're doing now that you were not doing before or not doing now that you were previously doing?
Well, so number one, with Tommy Angelo, I have just gotten much more zen and much less tilty. I don't know that the tilt bug ever goes away. But I've thought a lot about something you said, Andrew, on the special podcast for the people who gave to Bay Area Urban Debate League, that if you're going to run from a bear, first of all, you probably shouldn't run from a bear. but you don't have to be faster than the bear. You just have to be faster than your friend if you're both running from the bear. And I think there's a lot of that in these recreational poker games. You don't have to be the best 1-2 player. But if you can be better than the people you're playing with, that's an advantage. And I think tilt is one thing I've really worked on quite a bit. And the Tommy Angelo books, you know, took something that I knew I should do and really helped kind of solidify it for me, how I could work on doing it better. And then Ed Miller, I took a number of things from reading Small Stakes, No Limit Hold'em. And Ed, actually, I sent him a note thanking him for the book. He actually sent me his other book, The Game, which was incredible. I'm about halfway through that.
Oh, cool.
But one of the big things there was the two big things actually were it forced me to think even more about how to play position strongly in these games. And also, I think I was just leaving a lot of value on the river. And so I've gotten more aggressive at betting hands on the river and getting paid off more. And of course, relative to the pot size, those are really big bets in no limit games. Yeah. So that's been a really big help. Can I tell a quick tilt story?
Please.
Okay. So this was, to me, just like a perfect example. So I went to our local card room. In Minnesota, we do not have no limit. We have spread limit. So it was a 2-100 spread limit game with a $300 buy-in, and I started this hand with about $250 and played, honestly, what I would consider one of the worst hands of poker I've ever played. I had one of those meltdowns. A guy had just sat at the table. He was one of these chirpy, chatty guys. I had raised, he re-raised, and I'm just like, well, I'm going to show this guy because he's just talking. And I had a pair of sevens, so I max re-raised him, and at that point I had hardly anything left, so he put me in, I called, and of course he shows me two kings. And as the hand was done, I was like, what did I just do other than set $250 on fire?
You sure showed him, Tony.
Yeah, I'll show you, Mr. Chatty Man. Here's all my money. But I rebought, and I sat down, and I just said, okay, that was not your best play ever. In fact, it was downright awful. Move on, and let's focus here on how we go from here. And I took my next buy-in, and I ended up leaving for the night. I had a total of about $250. And I don't think I'd have been able to do that 18 months ago. I probably would have steamed. I would have chased the loss. And maybe if I'd gotten lucky in a few pots, I'd have won. But I feel like I'm able to control that a little bit better. And I really think that's directly a result of things I've heard on your show and reading Tommy Angelo.
That's great. Yeah, that's a great example. You've probably heard me say this before. Other people may have also. But I think, you know, there's one step of dealing with tilt, and kind of the first one a lot of people have to deal with or do learn to deal with anyway, which is just accepting that, you know, sometimes you have the best hand and you lose with it anyway. Like, you get it all in with you know, kings versus ace king, and they hit the ace or whatever, and you accept like that's just a part of poker, and that's a thing that happens. But I think at some point you have to accept that making mistakes or doing boneheaded things is also going to be a thing that happens. And you want to try to reduce that to the ability that you can, but I think you're never going to play so well that that's just not a factor at all. And I think it's a lot more important, or at least it's also an important skill, to be able to move on from a boneheaded mistake and not compound it, not chase the loss, ideally not even have it lead to the end of your session. I mean, if you're a recreational player, it's not the end of the world if you just, you know, go home that night and sleep it off or whatever. But certainly if you're a professional or you're trying to make money from playing poker, you don't want to have to essentially, you know, take off work because you're frustrated. So yeah, I think that's an excellent example.
Yeah, and I think it's actually a really good lesson for life in general. I have found, you know, so in my, you know, professional life, I work in marketing for a large company, and I don't get it right all the time. And my life is just a lot better when I can just even say the words, I screwed that up. It helps me move on and not dwell on it. And so I try to bring, you know, some of that into the poker table and then bring some of the things I learned from poker to life too.
Yeah, that's excellent. And I guess your brother plays poker as well, right? Because he was a factor in this hand. So we discussed one of your strategy segments, which is kind of the impetus for your coming on now. We discussed one of your strategy questions on the show a little while back, and it was an interesting one because you presented it from the perspective of both you and your brother, and you didn't tell us which one you were initially.
Correct. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's my youngest brother. There's three Newman boys, and Zach continues to play poker, plays with us occasionally in our home game. And yeah, so I just thought it was such an interesting hand from a standpoint of there wasn't just the way the hand played, but you do end up with a lot of the psychological dynamics when you have, you know, the oldest brother and the youngest brother clashing with some decent amount of money sitting on the table.
Yeah, so I know you had a couple of follow-up questions that you wanted to ask, or maybe only one of them is really a follow-up question strictly related to that, but I think Nate and I both kind of, I don't know if gave you a hard time is quite the right word, but pushed back on some of the advantages that you were asserting related to straddling. I think that's particularly for straddling under the gun. I think we're both pretty anti. Did you have a case that you wanted to make or anything you wanted to question us on there?
Well, yeah, and I guess, you know, the goal of this isn't to prove I'm right or to prove you're right, but it's a different viewpoint, and I'm really curious what you guys think, because believe it or not, I actually have put a lot of thought into this. Doesn't mean it's right, but it's not something I do just to do. So I actually make straddling a part of my game, and there's a few reasons for it. The first is that I think it helps build an image that I want. I personally think it's a cheap way to advertise this guy's an action player. And on the whole, for a 1-2 type of rec, I'm not the tightest player at the table, but I'm certainly not the loosest. And so I think building that image helps. I've actually had more at the casinos when I play, where I will have people say like, oh, you know, that guy, you know, well, that guy's straddling. He's an action player. And some of that could just be confirmation bias. But the way these games play too, they're just, I get where this would probably be very, very bad at a 5-10 game. But these 1-2 games are so loose pre-flop. There's a lot of fit or fold post-flop. And, you know, in the past year, I keep track of my wins and losses. I mean, I'm averaging 35 big blinds an hour over 90 hours this year. And a lot of that is getting in with kind of big hands versus average hands. And I actually think straddling helps with that, because when I do wake up with a good hand in the straddle, it doesn't seem like anybody believes me. And, you know, Ed Miller talks a lot about the 3-bet, 4-bet, 5-bet game that happens online. You don't see that live at these stakes. So a straddle counts as a raise. Sometimes there's one raise. A lot of times it gets limped back to me, and then I can see the flop with anything. So I think that can help as well. And then again, you know, the buy-ins are also pretty deep. I'm usually playing 150 to, you know, 200 big blinds deep. So I do feel that when I hit a hand, it's got some jackpot potential to it. And because I would say in general, I think I play better post-flop than the average player at the table, I also don't get over-committed. And then the last thing is, I can improve this, but I think I do it pretty well. I don't give in too much to the sunk cost fallacy. So I see, especially in our home game, there's a couple of us that'll straddle sometimes throughout the night. And I see other players who are like, well, I already have money in the pot. So if I put in, you know, if I straddled to, you know, $4 and someone made it 12, well, I got a call with this, you know, Jack Deuce suited or, you know, Queen six offsuit because I already have money in there. And I really don't do that. I mean, I play the hand like I would have played it, you know, if someone had just raised. And so I think that helps keep me out of trouble. So that's at least the excuse / justification. But I'm very curious what you guys think when you hear that.
Go for it. You want to go first? Good. So it's good that you don't get that you don't fall prey to the sunk cost fallacy, and it's good to fold your bad hands after those get raised, and that's really good. And your win rate is crazy, high enough that it makes me think that these are some of those like sort of 5-10 no limit games that just happen to have 1-2 blinds by convention or as a sort of formality or whatever, because that's huge. So good for you on that. I tend to remember the times when people say I'm a huge action player. If straddling is the only way to get that reputation and the reputation really helps you a lot, then, you know, you're there and I'm not, and I'll trust you on that. The question I would ask is, how much are you paying for these image plays, and is there a more cost-effective way of doing it? So putting in two big blinds dark under the gun, it's a bad play. I mean, depending how easy the game is, like, it should cost you at least 1.5 big blinds. Whereas, say, calling a raise dark from late position, so like something I've done at home games, if like I'm up getting a glass of water or something and my cards are on the button, like let's say it's a casual game where I can just do that during the deal and somebody raises, you can just call in the dark. Like, that's very, very noticeable. And you might think it's expensive, but in some cases, it's not. Or you can raise in the dark to three big blinds from late position if it's just limp to you or something. There are just a lot of ways to generate action. Also, if you're playing well, you're probably going to get a reputation as an action player anyway, just because you'll be, you know, betting and raising instead of limping and calling all the time. So, you know, it's one thing if straddling is the only thing that'll fit into these folks' conceptual scheme or that they'll notice, but there are some creative ways that may even be more memorable than straddling that are less expensive and even better for your image. What do you think, Andrew?
I think that's all smart, and I would also be inclined to question how much you really even need to cultivate that image. Because when I hear you describe the game, like when you say the game is already very loose pre-flop, as you get deeper, I guess it starts to be a little bit more of a concern, but probably your opponents are already making the mistake of being overly loose. So I don't know that you necessarily need to, they might just make a lot of loose mistakes against you, even without you having that sort of image. In general, I tend to think that image really only matters at the margins, and that a lot of people, and this isn't necessarily directed at you, just a general observation, mm-hmm. what I've found from hearing people talk about image, I think a lot of people worry way too much about image and don't think enough about fundamentals. So, you know, one thing that I hear a lot, and again, this is absolutely not something that you're saying, but one thing that I hear a lot is someone will just say, oh, you know, or one of my students will send me a hand that begins with them raising like 7-5 suited under the gun. And I was like, well, let's pause and talk about this one for a second. And well, I hadn't played a hand in a long time, and so I thought I had a tight image and I could get away with stealing. And so that's the sort of thing where even if you have a tight image, there's a fair chance no one has noticed that. Now, straddling is a good deal more noticeable than like not having played a hand in a few hours. There's a fair chance that you're the only one who realizes you haven't played a hand in a few hours, that no one else is really paying that careful attention, and you're just frustrated that you haven't gotten a hand in a while. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, I think also no one's folding ace queen to you anyway. Probably no one's folding ace jack or king queen. Like, people just are going to play hands. Like, for the most part, if they get dealt a hand that they want to play, they're going to play it. And the fact that someone seems to be a tight player isn't really going to deter them from doing it. They might be a little bit more, and the, you know, same thing after the flop. Like, if someone has trips, they're probably not folding it. And if you happen to have a full house or trips with a better kicker, you know, you don't need a really wild image to get paid by that player. Like, a lot of the money that you make from big hands just comes from situations where you have a big hand and someone else has a relatively good hand. And even if a really good player might be able to fold it in that situation, like, you're not playing with people who are extremely disciplined or fantastic hand raiders. So I guess I'm just inclined to think that a lot of the action that you're going to get is action that you're going to get anyway, and you're kind of paying, like Nate said, it's a very expensive thing to do, to straddle, and I think you're paying a lot for something that, you know, again, not being in the game, I can't really say for certain, but I'm pretty inclined to think that a lot of this action you're getting is probably action you would get anyway.
Yes. So a couple things I kind of think of as you guys are talking about this is one, admittedly, the big blinds per hour, regression to the mean is really going to be a son of a bitch when that hits me. There've actually been a couple of particular hands this year where there've been some very large pots I've won. I actually won the biggest pot I've ever won in a live game, somehow with pocket queens against someone with pocket fives. Not a really relevant story, but I understand that some of that's inflated. But the other thing is that what I do also notice, at least in the casino games, is because the straddles always have to be announced, everyone kind of looks and does notice, like, who's doing that. And so, again, I might be having an overly creative solution to a much simpler problem. But the one thing I do notice in these games, and this kind of ties into the big blinds per hour, is this idea of winning the blinds, which sounds like it's more important in online games and as you move up in live games, I don't want to say it's non-existent at this level, but I think it's a fairly minor consideration because there's just so few chances where it actually happens. I mean, if someone raises, it's almost always called, so that blind stealing and eking out some of those, you know, a few blinds here and there, to me doesn't seem as relevant, but I might also just not be looking at it the right way.
Well, no, I'm inclined to agree with that. I guess that, like, so that would be the if people were folding a lot to your preflop raises, that would be a reason why you would need to cultivate a more aggressive image. I think what you're saying about, you know, no one's folding preflop anyway, or like you never just raise and take a preflop anyway, is a reason why you don't really need to be concerned about building an aggressive image. That would be my argument.
So essentially, it's a little bit of fancy play syndrome.
I'm inclined to say so. Yeah, I mean, so if you were just one of my students coming to me and telling me, you know, I really want to straddle, or not I really want to straddle. You're coming to me and you're saying, I think there's very good strategic reasons why one ought to straddle. I would be inclined to think, it sounds to me like you just want to straddle, and you're making reasons for it sort of after the fact.
Okay.
Yeah, I think if a lot of people are straddling, then there are good reasons to straddle along with them. Yeah. Especially in this kind of environment. Is that the case?
Yeah, so when I play in my home game, and there are some differences between the home game and the probably casino game. In the home game, there's probably three of us of that straddle fairly regularly, like maybe half of our hands a night. And it's always under the gun. And then there's a handful of players that'll do it once or twice just to show they did it, but it's not a straddle game, so to speak. And in the casinos, when I do it, I'm usually the only person out on my island thinking this is a quasi good idea.
Yeah, I think the point Nate's getting at is a good one, which is, and these are the circumstances in which Isle Straddle is, if it is something that, you know, a lot of people are doing, or I think it's going to be kind of good for the game broadly. It's not something, it's certainly not something I would do like on a regular basis. I mean, I think it's very difficult to overcome losing 1.5 big blinds or whatever. I mean, and you're right that it helps that people aren't raising very aggressively. Like in a game where a lot of people are limping, you're certainly getting punished much less than you could be for straddling. And there might be kind of like social reasons too. Like if there's a, you know, player in the game who really wants to straddle and you want to keep that player happy, that would strike me as a good reason to straddle. But yeah, just in a vacuum, if we ignored that kind of secondary effect on the game and we just thought about, mm-hmm. Is it just purely for your personal image, is it necessary for you to get paid off? Like, you know, some of the examples you pointed to, like, well, when I get a Delta big hand in the straddle, I can win a lot of money with it. Like, yeah, if you know you're going to get dealt aces, you'd like to straddle. The problem is when you don't get dealt bad hands, then you lose a lot more money with them. Not even as a function of you. And again, like if you're not compounding the error, that's good. You know, if you're not going to feel inclined to call a raise with Jack Deuce just because you straddled or something. And maybe I'm a little biased because the hand that you sent us involved you putting in a lot of action after having straddled with a hand that I might not have done that with. But I believe you when you say that you're not habitually inclined to do that. But even if all you're doing is folding it pre-flop, you're still losing a lot more money with Jack Deuce than you would have if you had just been dealt Jack Deuce under the gun in a pot where you didn't straddle. Like, you would have just folded it pre-flop and saved that money. So yeah, I mean, I would be inclined to think that it's there's a tendency to remember the cases where you won big pots and perhaps even over attribute that to having straddled. I can't say for sure that, you know, that you are over attributing it, but I think it's also easy, because it's only two big blinds that you're losing, it's easy to just kind of round that down to zero and say like, oh, well, when I get bad hands, I just fold, no big deal. It is significant. Losing two big blinds, I mean.
Yeah. Okay, well, and I... Nate's given me some good things to think about too, about some other things you could do. So let me ask this from another angle. I'm also hearing a little bit of maybe this whole just thought in general of image cultivation is something I'm overthinking.
Yeah.
And just play your cards and go with it, and no one's paying attention to you anyway. Big shot.
that's basically, I mean, even aside from anything in particular that you've said, I just think as a background thing, a lot of people, recreational players in particular, think a lot more about image than I think it actually matters. Like, I think a lot of people, their thinking about image is way out of proportion to the actual importance of image. I think like the sort of baseline likelihood that you're inflating the importance of image is high.
Yeah. And I think a lot of your opponents will try to make some decisions based on who you are, but a lot of those decisions, well, will ultimately be the ones that they would have made anyway. And B, the things that you do to try to change your image are, you know, it's sort of a noisy function from image altering behavior to the actual alterations in the image that you get. Mm-hmm. And I have often found that the things that I thought would affect my image in a certain way in fact did not. And there's also just a lot you can do, like just being friendly and like not obviously being a huge nit about everything will go a long way. Like it's yeah, so, you know, just throwing money into the pot blind under the gun is only one of many ways. And yeah, I think image can be a bit overrated. I mean, it's also something you can test empirically, right? Like you can just not straddle. Then when you get a good hand under the gun, you can, I don't know, limp or raise or do whatever you're going to do with it, and then see if you fail to get action for, you know, a few sessions. And mm-hmm. if you really do fail to get action, and if you really think that you would have gotten way more action given that given the same cards that were out, if you think the straddling would have made a huge, huge difference, then, you know, you can start to rethink that. But, yeah, that's what I think.
No, that makes sense. And actually, I think probably more where the payoff tends to happen is I end up with a hand that I wouldn't have played. And if you get some limpers, and in the rare instances, granted, where you then hit a big hand, the ability to get paid off on those and win multiples of big blinds, it feels to me like something where I, and again, it's hard because I'm not doing this online, so I don't have a database to look at. It feels, and what I kind of hear maybe, is that it might be positive ROI, but it's likely not the most positive ROI you could play, which would be just playing your under the gun like you should play it.
I mean, you're allowed to play those hands anyway if you want. Like, if you really think that playing, you know, getting in the pot with Jack Deuce suited just in case you make a full house is worth doing, you can do it for one big blind instead of two. I mean, you're allowed to limp with those hands.
Yeah. And just to be clear, I think it was Jack Six, so it was a monster.
So I got, like, the point I want to make, though, is, you know, you're, like, there's a reason you don't play that hand unless you're forced to do it blind by straddling, which is
correct.
It's not profitable to be taking that hand under the gun. So, like, the stuff that you're talking about, you know, maybe I'll win a big pot if I happen to hit it or something. I mean, that's just offsetting a loss. It's not a downright profitable thing in its own right.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, button straddles are kind of a different story where there's, I mean, we just talked about this on, you'll get it soon, the second donor exclusive podcast. We talked a little bit about button straddles, which can be a bit of a different story. I'm also reminded, just when Nate mentioned the kind of image thing or not being a nit about everything, we recorded a long time ago a premium podcast with Carlos about... sort of introducing him to cash, which I think didn't really stick for him. I don't think he likes doing it. But for a while, he was playing in a home game where one of the things that people like to do at the end of the night was just do, I don't know, $10 or $20, you know, relatively small stakes, you know, just a couple of blind hands where, you know, there's no betting or anything. They're just dealing out cards and everyone, you know, turns up and sees who wins. And Carlos was saying he didn't like to participate in those, which, you know, obviously Carlos is sort of an epic nit. But what we were saying is, you know, you have to do that kind of thing. You can't show up at a home game where everyone else wants to gamble, where it's already kind of known that you're trying to make money or that you're a professional, and then just, you know, refuse to participate in any gamble that's not plus EV, even if it's just, like, you know, that's just a neutral EV gamble. So, I mean, I think you would want to avoid doing that sort of thing or something that just brands you as, like, a giant nit. That was just something I was reminded of when Nate made that comment. Oh.
Yeah, well, and honestly, that's where it started, was in the home game, because I do know relative to the table, I'm one of the tighter players pre-flop, and so I think it's a way to show the table, like, hey, I'm not just sitting here playing, you know, 10% of the hands. You know, I'm willing to get in and mix it up a little bit, so... But yeah, I think the larger point makes sense. I understand that.
Okay.
Yeah. Just for in case you need one more thing to have in your back pocket, assuming there's a game on, if you're watching the game, if you happen to every now and then say, like, fuck, and if somebody says, like, oh, are you a Yankees fan? You can say, no, but I'm a great fan of the Yankees -3.5 or something. And that's every bit as noticeable as straddling, and it costs you $0, unless, like, you would actually only do that if you made a bet, in which case it costs you the EV of a sports bet, which is probably less than 1.5 big blinds.
There you go. Fair enough.
So one of the other questions that you sent me, Tony, you labeled as an ethics question. Can we jump to that one and then come back to the second one,
yeah,
time permitting? Because the second one actually is something, another one that Nate and I just addressed. And I know you haven't heard it yet, but we recorded the second donor exclusive podcast yesterday, and I think there's going to be a decent amount of overlap. So if there's one that we don't get to, I'd rather skip that one.
No, that's fine. And actually, you covered it a little bit when you talked about one of your hands in the first exclusive too. Oh, so okay, so that's fine. So here's the question. So our home game is there's, let's call it a core group of 15 of us that we send sort of the first wave invite out to, and if the game fills up at 9 or 10, the game is full, we have the game and move on. And then we have a local site that we use that we pull players from. They're somewhat vetted, so we, you know, feel fine if people from that list join us. And we had a guy join us a few months ago who is just objectively a bad player, showed up, spewed off a few hundred bucks, was a nice guy, and as he left, we're kind of saying, okay, well, we'll add him to the list. So the next month, he became part of our kind of first wave invite, and he showed up and spewed off another $300 or $400. And then he's kind of started talking as well, speaking of Yankees -3.5, that he's doing all this sports betting, and as he's talking more about the way he gambles and what he does, it starts to feel to us like this guy might have a little bit of a problem. And he emails the host with all these like football games he's betting on, and it's gotten a little bit awkward. So after last month's game, that was the third month he played, he showed up, he dusted off a few $100. The rest of us kind of sat there and were like, well, what should we do? Because on one hand, he's an adult, he's, you know, no one's making him come to the game, and he's probably going to lose that money somewhere. But on the other hand, it feels it doesn't feel really good that we're now purposely inviting someone who we don't feel like has much of a chance, and is basically going to dust off money to a bunch of us. So I was very curious, when you combine thinking poker with Knitcast theories, where this nets out with you guys.
One quick follow-up question for you. The way you described it, just at the very end, you said, you know, it doesn't feel like he has much of a chance. But earlier, it kind of made it sound like you didn't feel like he necessarily had complete control over his decisions, or some people might say like compulsive gambler, problem gambler, or something like that. Would you say the central problem is just that he's very bad, or would you say the central problem is that he seems to have a relationship with gambling that you're not comfortable with?
It's a little more that he has a relationship with gambling that maybe we're not comfortable with. I mean, for the most part, everyone in these games has professional jobs, for sure can afford to lose the money. Mm-hmm. Don't like to lose it, but you know, it doesn't ruin anyone's week. Mm-hmm. Not sure about him. And he even just says weird things, like he told us about, oh, I went to this casino and I won $1,000 playing poker. And we're like, oh, wow, really? He's like, yeah. He's like, well, and then I lost $1,500, but I had won $1,000. And it's like, well, right, that's not how math works, but okay.
Yeah. I can start if you like, or Andrew can. Well, if you were asking a follow-up question, I can let you finish your thoughts.
There was that. I guess I had one other separate follow-up question I wanted to ask also, which is, do you find that it reduces your own enjoyment of the game to have him in it? I mean, is it at the point where it makes you downright uncomfortable to be playing with him, or is it more you're like, I mean, look, we're happy to have the money. I just sort of, I don't know if it's the right thing to do.
This is still being recorded, right?
Yeah.
Okay. It doesn't personally affect my enjoyment. It's more awkward. It's become a little bit of a nuisance. The group has been talking about it, but at the same time, I've not lost any sleep over it.
Okay.
So maybe I'm just a horrible person.
what were you going to say, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple thoughts that maybe we'll just sort of start the conversation. Mm-hmm. One is that I think it's a really hard question, sort of what any individual game's obligations are. Especially, like, it can be a sort of thin rationalization that, like, well, if he doesn't lose it here, he'll lose it somewhere else. But, like, I really do think that it's important to consider sort of that counterfactual. And I think that's, you know, like a... it's like a really, we make a lot of our moral decisions based on counterfactuals like that. Like, if I don't pick up this piece of trash, will somebody else, and under what circumstances, you know, et cetera. And I think those things really do matter. A second thought is that, you know, it's important to really understand where this person's coming from. Some people just like to pretend to be problem gamblers to get action. Like, you know, I mean, some people are really trying to get action when they show up to a poker game. And then there are people who just really like to gamble. Then there are problem gamblers. And there have been people who I've thought of as problem gamblers who have turned out just to be sort of lifestyle gamblers, people who just like to be in action. And like, I count myself as one of these people. I enjoy being in action. I have like a little spreadsheet that keeps track of all my prop bets, and I like it when it's long. So that's that. And I think what you should do is like very different in those two cases.
Well, so, can I add, so one of the things on that makes this for us a little bit harder is if it was one of our core group,
yeah,
I think one of us would feel very comfortable sort of having a little side conversation.
Yeah.
But we also don't really know this guy other than he's shown up at the game a few times. So yeah, there's not really a delicate way to go, like, do we just slip him the Gambler's Anonymous brochure, like, when he's leaving?
Yeah. So, I mean, as somebody who runs a business, can I sort of share a couple I mean, you're experienced in business also, is like, when there's something I want to accomplish, but it would be weird if it was me doing it, you know, I can always say that, you know, that's the policy, you know, it's there's that Seinfeld episode, even I'm not above the policy, and it's like the owner of the corner store. And like, you can always say like, and I think it's a laudable thing and something that I would try to do if somebody's a problem gambler, to discourage them from playing and to alert them to the habit. But you can say like, hey, you know, at this game, you know, we try to keep it friendly and positive and constructive. And this is impersonal, but when somebody shows up and loses, we put a stop loss on them, and they can only buy in for 100, and that's their stop loss for the night. It's nothing personal, but we just like to cultivate an atmosphere where, you know, where people who might have a problem start to look somewhere else, and you know, if we have certain kinds of players in the game, it's bad for the health of the game over the long term. So, you know, nothing personal, but, you know, the policy does apply to you. And so we're going to ask you to buy in short or keep yourself to one buy-in next time. And that's that. And then that's like, especially if you make it known that the policy has something to do with discouraging problem gambling in your game, then the person will get the message, right? And it'll be still sort of like a positive change that you guys can make. But then it's not him. It's like, boy, Larry, you really suck, and we think you have a problem. Like, no, it's just, you know, it's like a withdrawal limit on your credit card. You know, it's like, you know, I'm sorry, this is the casino. We just have it so that you can only go to the ATM once. You know, that's how it is. I'm sure you're fine. So if you decided you wanted to intervene, I think that might be a delicate way to do it. Bad idea, good idea. Andrew, what do you think?
I'm thinking. It's hard for me to imagine actually being the person doing that. Like, that feels like a kind of awkward, especially if the person knows that hasn't been the policy prior. Like, if you've, you know, they've been playing for a while, and then one day you're like, no revise for you. It feels to me like an awkward thing to do. I guess it's more important whether it feels to Tony like an awkward thing to do.
Well, but like, I mean, the idea is that this is a newcomer to the game. He doesn't know all your things. Like, and it may in fact turn out that this was the policy all along. You just didn't know it, right? Like, that you would have done. Like, this is a first time thing. It's like, hey, and like, also, you really don't want, like, having a problem gambler who's just going to lose money is like one thing, but like, not to say that self-interest and his interest, you know, totally coincide here, but like, if somebody's really in trouble and booking sports bets with God knows who and all that, like, unless you have really good security at this game, you may really not want him there, right? I don't know. Like, and it can be as simple, like, this is only a list you go on to sometimes. You can say, like, hey, you know, we do, you know, you're invited back this Thursday, but just so you know, we have a policy where, you know, people who don't cash out twice in a row, they can only buy in once or something. I don't know. Maybe this is a bad idea, but it's something I'd consider. What do you think, Tony?
Well, it's certainly an idea.
Speaking of delicate.
Sorry, that was the marketer coming out.
That's really good.
No, I could see myself
actually doing this. I'm glad you guys are on it.
So there's a couple of things, I guess, that I would find a little bit challenging about that. One is we have a finite number of seats in the game. So even if we have someone show up and now we have to, you know, put a stop loss in, we in theory could have filled that seat with someone else who we maybe wouldn't have had to put a stop loss on. I also wonder, too, and we've talked about this, if there's not a simpler solution that we just kind of try to lose the guy's email. how much obligation do we have to say something to him? What I'm hearing, though, is that probably inviting him back in the way we have, we should not do that.
I mean, I'm not convinced of that. Like, if you really think this guy's not okay and you're party to him ruining his life, then I would, in fact, not do that. And I've made similar decisions before. But, like, you know, I think one thing you mentioned, did you mention this on the air, that there's some sports betting going on? We can cut this out if you didn't. Yeah, I mean, when you say he, like, loses and loses and loses at that, it's like, you know, it's impossible. Like, if he's really that good at picking losers in football, then, you know, then he's the best football pick in the world, just with a change of sign. You know, like, you can just take his picks and get rich off them. Like, I mean, like, obviously, if he's betting enough, then the vigorish will kill him eventually. But
because he's losing at that too. And
everybody's losing at that.
Correct.
Like, and everybody's losing almost the exact same amount at that. Like, namely, whatever the vig is on the bet, plus or minus half a percent, based on how good they are at picking.
Unless they're borrowing money to do it.
Yeah, that's bad.
And we had talked too that if this were a casino, none of us would feel obligated to say or do anything, because you have to make the commitment to go walk in there and do it. But we feel like, because it's a home game and there's inviting, and again, maybe the theme for today is I can start something called the Overthinking Podcast, that we're helping make it happen in this situation, as opposed to it's not just at someone's house and whoever shows up plays.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I would definitely hold, and I have held home games to a higher standard than that. Like, because it's different. You have a different connection to this person, and you're just differently situated. And second, because, like, everything from sort of awkward, unpleasant interactions, which you're already having, to, like, this guy being in debt and needing to get desperate, are all, like, possible, and they're all things that really happen. And, like, yes, I'm, you know, you know much better than I do how much at risk you are in this respect. But, like, I think, you know, not only do you want to do the right thing and not do too much to facilitate this person's problem gambling, but, like, also I think it really is just, from a self-interested perspective, bad for you to be playing with this kind of problem gambler, at least if it is what it sounds like it is.
Yeah, I think it kind of sounds to me like there's two different questions here. One is, you know, three questions. Like, one, is there a kind of self-interested reason why you might want to say something to this person, which, I mean, partly what I was getting at when I asked, like, does it decrease your enjoyment to play with him? But I think, Nate, you make some good points about maybe some other practical considerations as well. B, there's a question of, even if the answer to that is no, if we can somehow determine that, like, it's definitely in the group's interest to have this guy in the game definitively, you know, is there still some obligation to sort of not invite a problem gambler, in the same way that if you're going out drinking and you thought he was an alcoholic, you maybe wouldn't feel good about inviting him to come with you or something. And then the third question is, like, if we decide yes to one of those first two questions, then, you know, what do you do about it? I guess I'm inclined to say to kind of conflate the first two. Like, I think if you, I'm not inclined to say that there's kind of like an absolute moral obligation, especially if you're not really confident that the person even has a, you know, a downright problem, you know, problem in like a clinical sense of gambling. Then I would say, you know, if it doesn't make you uncomfortable, I wouldn't say that you necessarily have like a definitive obligation not to expose him to gambling or not to invite him to gambling or something. And I would then just sort of collapse it into the are there practical problems? Is it reducing anyone's enjoyment? Is it making anyone uncomfortable, either in an ethical way or in a, you know, just in terms of the security of the game or something like that?
Can I also just, from a slightly defensive place, say that I have seen it done where, you know, anywhere from saying like, hey, are you sure you want to rebuy? Sure you don't need a walk first, to like, hey, I don't think you can rebuy tonight. Like, I've seen it done, and people who are better with words, like maybe people who are marketers for a living, could pull it off. Maybe not me, but I've seen it done effectively.
Yeah, I'll find one of those marketer folks and see if they can help with that.
Yeah. Or maybe his brother. I don't know.
What's the advantage of keeping him on the list, other than that he's good action? I mean, it seems like people aren't really, like, it doesn't sound like anyone's here with the primary purpose of trying to make money. Is it just that, you know, you need players badly enough that like having someone who will show up is useful to you?
No. So, I mean, we've over the years, I think, curated the game. He's a nice guy. I mean, so, you know, at this point, I don't think anyone feels there's any danger of a threat. That might be naive, but he's a fun guy to play with. And I think I'd correct a little bit what you said. I think actually it's a serious home game in the sense that I think everyone's there to win. It's just maybe people's skill levels are different and their, you know, their strategy for how they go about trying to win. But everyone's there trying to win.
Well, I don't mean that you're not trying to win, but I mean like the reason that you're trying to win isn't that you're like relying on money from this game for
correct
income or something like that. Like it's, I guess it's not like a really cutthroat like win at all cost sort of. Or is it?
If we can inflict a little pain on each other. Yeah, but it's not, this home game is not part of anyone's like job/income stream. Mm-hmm. We've even over the years, we've had a couple of other players, we've actually just, again, sort of lost their email if they don't give a lot of action or if they're not like, you know, a good personality fit for the game. Mm-hmm. We actually had a guy a few months ago who, it was actually a hand I was in with him, and I was asking how much he had, and he said, well, I don't have to tell you, which is true. And I was like, yes.
I don't have to invite you back either.
But he had all these jankety stacks, and I couldn't even get a real fair estimate. I'm like, but then I need your chips where I can make an approximation. And he actually pushed all of his chips down into just a giant pile.
Yeah.
And we were like, what? Like, wow. So he didn't get invited back, but that was, again, it's a fun game. We're not looking for that kind of attitude.
Right.
This other guy's perfectly pleasant. He's pretty hopelessly horrible. And again, if he doesn't go play at our game, he's probably going to go play somewhere else. So even though I'm not sure the way Nate first said it is exactly how I would say it, maybe there is something around how we can make him aware of a new rule or of a rule that's existed that you know, he now needs to do around the buy-in cap or something like that.
And I do think like the simpler solution of just losing his email has a lot to be said for it also.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd be more inclined towards the passive aggressive approach of losing the email, but that might just be my own cowardice.
Yeah. Well, I'm from Minnesota. Good. We like our passive aggressiveness, so.
Well, thanks, Tony, for your both your donations and for being such a long time contribute, like Nate said, you know, part of the, and I guess I kind of made this point on Twitter as well, like, this is not sort of a standard policy of, like, make a donation and, you know, and anyone can come on the show and talk to us. But, you know, having met you and knowing that you've been a part of the Think Poker community for a long time and knowing that you're a long time listener and that you've asked good questions in the past and all that sort of thing, it was our pleasure to have you on the show. And yeah, just it's great that you've been doing that. It's great to hear that you're having success as a result of it, and we appreciate you.
Well, yeah, thanks, guys. I mean, this is a geek's dream come true. It was funny because you and I were going back and forth a little bit too, Nate, on what my kids, or I'm sorry, Andrew, what my kids had said when I told them about this, and they're like, well, how much money did you have to donate? And I always like to ask. I like to know what they think. They're 11 and 9. By the way, happy birthday, Charlie. Charlie's 11 today. And the first guess was one of them guessed $3,000 and one of them guessed $1,000. So to be fair, had that been the number, we probably wouldn't have had this conversation. But I was happy to do it. And, you know, with all the not only entertainment, but just information and good poker strategy you guys have provided me over the years on my many commutes into work. I'm happy to do that and support something important to you, and appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, well, have these kids who want to pay $3,000 to be on the show, put them in touch with me.
Okay.
it's a pleasure to meet you, not on Twitter. It's a very, very, very good to talk to you.
Hey, Nate, before we sign off, where's the running?
The running is your
5K.
Yeah, the running is, I hurt my ankle, so my running now happens in a pool. I'm aqua jogging, which is good for fitness and bad for, it's boring. So my fitness is good. My health is better than it's been in a while, knock on wood. So that's all going great, but specifically the running, my body did not hold up to it. So I have not given up on the goal, and I'm doing well at taking care of my body these days. But yeah, running is not cards for a couple more weeks.
Well, good luck, and thanks again for having me on, guys. I appreciate it.
All right, take care, Tony.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye.
Rain, cold rain, tapping on my window. Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law?
Oh, that's Nate with the sideways hat and everything.
Yeah, I sort of a Nick Cast thing. Blinds are like really expensive. in the window is to my right, so I just got a running cap and I wear it sideways until such time as I can afford the blind.
Excellent.
Yeah. I have like a little spreadsheet that keeps track of all my prop bets, and I like it when it's long.